We generally like small mammals. We live with cats and dogs and get all googly around fuzzy rabbits and gerbils and things. Rats, well, with rats we often draw a line. They may be cute in a pet store window, but not so much in the trash can outside the back door in the dark of night. The April issue of National Geographic magazine is about cities, ideas for a brighter future, and one thing we associate with cities is rats. Emma Maris is a Klamath Falls-based journalist. She wrote a wide-ranging article called How Rats Became an Inescapable Part of City Living. This is a revisit for Emma, who joined us in November of 2017 to talk about her coverage of OR4, one of Oregon's late and most notable wolves, now dead. She wrote that piece for Outside. So, Emma Maris, good to have you back on the Jefferson Exchange.
Great to be here.
So, could the venues for the OR4 story and this piece be any more different?
Well, they're both about mammals. Mammals we have strong feelings about.
Yeah, indeed. But let's move on to rats, because the strong feelings about them are they tend to be a lot more to the negative, it would seem.
Yeah, definitely. I think the rat lovers are very much in the minority.
So let's talk about the title of the piece. Are rats really inescapable?
I think that creating a city in which rats couldn't live would be an extremely difficult challenge, and that would be many decades in the future, I think, to get to that point.
They just are really good at adapting to conditions, aren't they?
Yeah, they're really smart, they're really adaptable, and they've kind of hitched their wagons to us, and they have learned how to live in our world just really effectively, so much so that sometimes we have no idea how many are actually living among us.
So I guess I'm going to ask that question anyway. Do we have any idea? I mean, do we have a rough number?
No. I mean, one thing that I really wanted to do for the story was tell people how many rats there are, either in the world or in New York or nothing. They're just so good at hiding in the tiniest little cracks that it's impossible to even estimate. So all estimates are kind of back of the envelope guesses, but there is a sense that they are growing in number.
Well, really?
That's right.
Despite our best efforts, though, and you point out quite a few of the best efforts in the article in the National Geographic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we trap them, we poison them. Increasingly, big cities like New York are using dry ice in the burrows to try to get rid of them. But they're fabulous reproducers. They're really good at hiding. And with the climate warming, it's becoming easier for them to live year-round in colder and colder places. And there's also just more of us packed into cities, and more people means more trash.
Okay, that's the big one, the ongoing people with rats connection. So in nature, and I know you have some deep thoughts on how we define nature, I want to get to those, are rats found where people are not?
Yeah, so both of the kind of main rat species that live in our cities now, the Norway or brown rats and the roof rat or black rats, they started out as wild mammals. One lived in the steppes, one lived in India. But it was a long time ago, in the case of the black rat, you know, probably more than 1,000 years ago, that they could kind of discover that they could thrive better alongside humans than they could out eating little insects and grains in the grasslands.
So they we're providing more of a buffet for rats than they would get it from nature?
Yeah, exactly. Scientists call them synanthropes. So they're kind of species that have decided that their habitat is now our habitat. That's their natural habitat is, in a sense, our cities.
Would that category of synanthropes, would that include things like cats and domestic dogs?
Well, those would be more domestic animals. Mm-hmm. Those were the ones we actually have to drive to the food store and buy pet food for. But Right. Things like sparrows, spiders, pigeons, gray squirrels, all the animals that thrive in our cities that we don't have to actively take care of.
So because of the things that we do and the stuff we leave hanging around, they end up hanging around us.
Yeah, I mean, if we had an incredibly tight, efficient food system, there wouldn't be all this sort of leakage for these other species, but we don't. We have a lot of trash. We have a lot of waste. Our houses have a lot of gaps in them. And so we create space and resources for them. It's not their fault that they've figured out this is a great place to live.
You know, the gaps don't have to be big. I notice you point out in the article that the Norwegian rats, the brown rats, the heads are really the widest part of their body. So assuming
Right.
they can get their head through a space, everything else can come with them.
Yeah, exactly. I was just looking this morning at advice from the Oregon State Extension about how to rat-proof your chicken coop, and they said you have to close any hole bigger than a nickel.
Wow. That's amazing. Okay, the things we're learning about rats. One of the things, too, when you mentioned the roof or black rats, I mean, that actually is genus and species, Rattus rattus?
That's right.
That's got to be the most unfortunate Latin name of all the animal kingdom. We're talking to Emma Maris from Klamath Falls, who wrote the piece for National Geographic called How Rats Became an Inescapable Part of City Living. You can join our conversation on the Exchange about rats and perhaps some of your encounters with them at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You know, before I got to your piece, I saw the National Geographic video from 4 years ago about rats coming up through toilets, and
Right. You
mentioned the same ability in your second paragraph. So does that happen often?
It happens frequently enough, you know, especially in Seattle, which is where I'm originally from, that it, you know, it has its own phrase, toilet bowl emergence. And I think that, you know, maybe in my first draft it wasn't in the first paragraph, but I think my editor had a good sense that this is something that is deeply troubling to the human psyche and something that would probably get readers really interested to read on.
So is there any reason why Seattle seems to be particularly more prone to toilet bowl emergence?
My guess is that has something to do with the way that the sewer system is structured, because it's a low-lying city with a high water table. But I'm speculating there. I don't know for sure. Maybe, you know, what's interesting about rats is because they're such clever little animals, they kind of develop distinct cultures. It could be that the rats of Seattle just have a tradition of scurrying around in the sewer pipes.
Were there lots of surprises for you in researching the piece in the habitats and abilities of rats?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that my respect for rats really grew over the process of reporting this. You know, I saw them initially as sort of an undifferentiated mass of kind of vaguely frightening and slightly disgusting animals, but they are little individuals, and the way that they have their, you know, the way that they protect their offspring, the way that they have little territories, that they, when they grow up, they go out and search for a mate, and how flexible they are behaviorally really surprised me.
Give us a quick sketch, if you would, Emma, on size, life cycle, fertility, a couple of basic things about rats.
So rats are extremely fecund. They can have just litter after litter of pups. And, you know, somewhere around 5 to 10 per litter. So they, National Geographic's data wizards did a little bit of back-of-the-envelope calculation, and they figured that if you started with one pregnant rat at the beginning of the year, and if all of her offspring survived and all of their offspring survived and so on, you could have more than 11,000 rats by the end of the year.
From that one pregnant rat?
That's correct.
Oh, boy.
Now, in practice, they don't all live. They have predators. In fact, part of the reason that urban centers like New York have raptors like owls and hawks living in them is because they have rats to eat. So they have their predators, too, not just the exterminator.
Okay, so interesting. There's a bit of an ecosystem, it sounds, then built around rats in big cities.
Yeah, and for me, the fact that they are a major, if not the predominant food source for the red-tailed hawks that have really captured the imagination in New York was a really interesting moment, because I realized that if New Yorkers got their wish and all the rats suddenly disappeared, they would also take with them this kind of larger ecosystem, and they would also stop eating all the trash that's on the streets, so presumably that trash would just continue to pile up and rot. I realized that in a weird way, they're actually performing some ecological services that perhaps we actually like.
Wow, that's going to take some thinking. let's talk about intelligence, because it seems like rats not only are wily, but I mean they've got some real skills at figuring things out, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the sort of rat in the maze phrase is there for a reason. They've often been used as an experimental subject to look at problem solving and decision making. But they have a loving side, too. A really fascinating set of experiments by Peggy Mason shows that if you put one rat in a cage and then you give another rat the opportunity to free this first rat, it will often do so and might even choose to free its fellow rats above getting a tasty food reward like chocolate. And then once the rat is out of the cage, it'll sort of jump all over it and lick it and seem to be very empathetic. And those kinds of experiments, again, really kind of made me reconsider how much I had viscerally disliked rats. They're animals that seem to care for each other.
Wow. So empathy in rats, that's, you've been reading about this a bit, and it's really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Emma Maris is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She is a Klamath Falls-based freelance journalist and the author of a piece in the current issue of the National Geographic, which is all about cities. Her piece is How Rats Became an Inescapable Part of City Living. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about rats and all the things they're capable of. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Not surprisingly, some people have some things to say about rats, starting with Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Emma.
Howdy.
Hi.
All right. I'd like to try to show the warm and fuzzy side of rats, if I may. I have a personal anecdote. When I was growing up with my siblings, one of my sisters had a pet rat. She named it Puddin, and it was basically scampering around in the apartment complex area where we were. Didn't need to be restrained or anything like that. Seemed very obedient and very intelligent and very smart. There were no other rats involved because she was a single rat. And my question to Emma is there a difference between your domesticated, like, warm and fuzzy rat and the rats that we tend to think of as vermin?
All right, so your pet store rat and the ones in your trash can, difference. Okay, thanks for the question, Jamie. Appreciate that.
Yeah, that's a great story. I don't think the differences are major. Certainly, a lot of pet rats are bred for interesting coat colors, and they're definitely bred for a sort of docility. So I spoke with a rat breeder for the story who kind of is always trying to create the calmest possible rat, a rat that won't bite you when you pick it up out of the cage. But I wouldn't say that they have created, you know, it's not the difference between a wild boar and a domestic pig. I don't think it's that grand of a difference. I think it would probably be possible to tame a wild rat if you got it young enough. I don't know. Interesting question.
Okay, and we have another call here from John and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange as we discuss rats with Emma Maris.
Hi.
Hi.
I live in a kind of a fall-down house in a funky yard. There's piles of woody debris here and there and so on. So I think rats, how reasonable is it to think that the domestic cat population in a neighborhood is any kind of a control at all of rats?
Oh, excellent question. Thanks for that, John.
Yeah, that's a great question and one that I did look into a little bit for the reporting. So domestic cats and even sort of what you might call like a farmyard cat, a cat that sort of doesn't come inside, that's a little bit kind of left to its own devices, they'll kill rats for sure, but they won't necessarily go after an adult Norway rat, which can be 9 inches long and a pretty formidable prey item for a cat, even a tough cat. So cats are probably better at killing mice, but either mice or rats, they tend to reproduce quickly enough and to be smart and careful enough that you'd wait a long time for cats to completely eliminate a population of rodents. They might keep a lid on their growth or expansion, but I don't think they're ever going to eliminate them completely.
I had a relative once who thought, well, you know I got some rats that come into the apartment, but my cats will take care of that. And then she swears, this was in New York City too, that the guy said, you know, rats can get like 2 pounds.
Yes.
She said, that's it. She plastered up the hole. They don't apparently get that big from what you found out.
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, when you are walking in the twilight and you come around the corner and you're confronted with an extremely large rat, it can seem like it's 2 pounds. But I don't think that they get quite that big. But they do, you know, they're long-bodied and extremely tough. So I think some cats find them challenging for sure.
Well, and humans do too. You know, when you flick on the light in the bathroom at 6 a.m. and it's sitting on the sink staring at you, it seems very large at that moment.
Exactly.
So cats aside, you got some pictures. Charlie Hamilton James was the photographer on this project, and he got some amazing work in here. The pictures from the rat roundup in Washington, D.C. So not cats, but dogs. What was going on there?
So this is a new trend. Partly, part of the reason that people are turning to dogs to do rat control is because they don't want to use poisons. Poisons not only kind of take a long time to kill these rats, and so are perhaps actually less humane than being quickly dispatched by a dog. But they also can poison other wildlife that people do want, like the owls and hawks I mentioned earlier. So people have started looking into using terriers to kill rats. They're bigger than cats. They're specially trained to do this, and they clearly enjoy their work. Charlie and I went out with a firm called Unique Pest Management based in the D.C. area, and their goal for the evening was to clear one alley in a very popular, busy restaurant neighborhood of Washington, D.C. of rats. And we saw their dogs and their human helpers kind of find and kill 31 rats in about half an hour.
There's one picture that if people take nothing else from the article on rats in the National Geographic, that they have to see the one with the dogs, two dogs, one rat. The rat's already in the mouth of one of the dogs. There's this odd zone between, oh, cute puppy, and oh, my God, I wouldn't get my hand near that thing.
Yeah, I got to, you know, give a lot of respect to Charlie. As I was standing sort of in the corner of the alley clutching my notebook, he was getting right up in the middle of this mix-up between these large, tough rats and these incredibly fierce and very excited terriers. And he was in the mix with them in order to get that shot. It was really something.
Yeah, he was so close the rat was out of focus and the dog was in focus.
Right, yeah, it was intense. We both had rats scurry over us as they tried to flee this. It was really intense, you know, and coming from learning all this stuff about how rats are empathetic and loving and take care of their offspring, I did feel sorry for them. But on the other hand, they did die quite quickly, and I think that if I was a rat, I might rather go this way than the poisons.
You know, from what you've been saying so far about the things that happen, the poisons, the dry ice in New York, which, of course, releases carbon dioxide, just sort of, you know, makes them not breathe anymore. It always seems more like pruning than extermination, that rats are always able to come back.
Yeah, that's right. That's well put. I mean, ultimately, you know, in New York, they put their trash out on the curb in big black plastic bags. They don't even put them inside dumpsters. They just sit there. Until they stop doing that, they're never going to get rid of their rats. It's not going to happen. They're basically, and there's a certain cruelty to it on a larger level. I mean, we're creating these cities that are perfect habitats for these creatures, and we're putting food out every night, almost as if to say, come here, come live with us. And then we think, oh no, there's too many of them, and we kill them. It's a little tough on them.
All right, so we are in fact feeding them, whether we intend to or not.
That's right.
Emma Maris is a Klamath Falls-based freelance journalist. Her piece in the National Geographic issue on cities, the April issue, is called How Rats Became an Inescapable Part of City Living. You can join our conversation on The Exchange. Share a story about rats or your concerns about them. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So it's not just that we feed them, but in some places, rats are venerated. You showed us a temple in India where there's a bit of, it's almost rat worship in a way.
Yeah, they're considered to be sort of reincarnated souls, and they're fed and not killed and kind of treated like honored beings. And I also went to an island in New Zealand where a group of Maori people are trying to preserve a particular species of rat from being killed off by the Department of Conservation. So there are people who, not just the pet owners, but there are whole cultures that see rats in a different way.
In fact, they are food in places, too, you point out.
Right. So the Maori, I was really interested in this story. The Maori brought a third species of rat, the Pacific rat, with them when they explored the Pacific Ocean and when they settled in New Zealand, when they kind of discovered that land. And they brought them with them intentionally as food. They kind of let them go in the forest, and then they would create little pitfall traps for them and capture them and cook them in their own fat. Then they sort of would be preserved that way for a long time. It was sort of a traditional wedding food, I'm told.
Wow, that's amazing. So speaking of rats, when they get taken to new places, when they get into new ecosystems, how much havoc can they wreak?
So that's how I'm sort of by, if I had a business card, who does these days?
Right.
If I had a business card, it would say environmental reporter. And that's how I originally got interested in this subject, is because when rats show up on places that have no experience of land-based predators or of really clever ones like rats, they can cause a lot of ecological havoc. Seabirds in particular are particularly susceptible to them. So there's a lot of islands dotted around the world's oceans where rats have shown up and just started eating away at the eggs and nestlings of seabirds and are a real threat to the continuation of some species.
Yeah, I took a look at your TED talk of a couple of years ago, and you take some issue with how many people define nature now. What's the exception you take there?
Well, a lot of my work looks at the way that humans and nature interact. And so I take issue with the notion that nature can be defined sort of by the absence of humans, because I think that there's a lot of problems with that, probably more than I can get into in one appearance. You'll have to have me back.
Okay.
But but I do think that, you know, all over the world, humans and nature have been in relation. We are a part of nature, and we've been in relationship with it for thousands of years. You know, one tendency in, for example, in North American conservation that I've criticized is the tendency to imagine that when Europeans got here, they stepped off the boat and saw something like a virgin wilderness that was untouched by humanity. That kind of attitude was prevalent for many, many decades, but it completely erased the fact that there were thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people living here and manipulating the environment for thousands of years. So the idea that there is some sort of nature out there that's completely untouched by humans is, I think, sort of a red herring and leads us to make bad choices sometimes in conservation.
We've had a hand in all of it, for sure. So is there a zone to be found on rats between some kind of live and let live attitude and yuck, kill them all?
Yeah, I think that's ultimately the question that my piece raises, and I don't think it fully answers it. But I think, you know, I certainly don't think that if you really press people, I think that few would say that we should kill every single Norwegian rat in the entire world. I don't think that anyone wants to see their species go extinct. So then the question is, what is the proper place for them? Probably not on these seabird islands, because they can threaten other species with extinction. But do they belong in our cities? Is it possible that we should accept a very, you know, a certain population of them in our cities? That's a kind of a far out possibility, but one I'm willing to entertain.
All right. We haven't seen the last of rats by a long shot. We got an email from Becca in Lane County who says, I love rats. And she gives some examples of ways that rats built these nests and mounds on her property, and they gather fallen apples to store around the perimeter, for example. She says, my younger son lives in New York City and said there are rats everywhere, not just in quote unquote bad areas. So back to where we started with Emma Maris. Her piece in the National Geographic Cities Ideas for a Brighter Future issue is called How Rats Became an Inescapable Part of City Living. Emma is based in Klamath Falls, a freelance journalist traveling the world. Emma, thanks so much for joining us again on The Exchange.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. Thank
All
you.
Right. Take it easy.